Check 1-2. Much better. Check 1-2. It's Monday, September 17th. We're in next door to Donald Smith's office, and we're going to talk about the merged University of Wisconsin system and Professor Smith's part in that in the early 70s. I think the first thing we want to talk about then is your arrival.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In September of 73 and the background there.
Well, I actually came in March of 73. I had been in a series of positions in the what we call the central administration of the University of Minnesota at Minneapolis, and the most recent of them, for about the last 4 years, I'd been vice president for administration. Earlier, I'd been in the academic affairs office for the system. This was the sort of last 9 years of a more than a 20-year stint at the University of Minnesota, where I'd gone as a faculty member when I left Madison, and been through the department, departmental chairman, and finally went into the system administration with the intention of staying only 3 years and then returning to the department, but it got dragged out. And in 1970, fall of 1971, I had decided that I had probably accomplished most of what I was going to accomplish, and asked President Moose if I could avail myself of an administrative leave. And he said that would be possible, kind of a comparable to the sabbatical leave system at the University of Minnesota, and that he assumed I would return to my vice president's job mm-hmm. when I had finished it. But I told him that while I would certainly discuss it with him, I was really not certain I wanted to whether I wanted to continue as vice president or wanted to go back into the Department of Communication, or speech communication, as it's now called there. I had no sooner worked out these arrangements than I heard from Robert Clodius, who was then the vice president at the University of Wisconsin, or who had been under mm-hmm. President Harrington. And when he left the administration of the University of Wisconsin, he had taken a position as head of the Indonesian project, which was an inter-university project of five big research universities in the Middle West. And he was getting started on his this work, and had decided that he wanted a resident director for the project living in Jakarta and serving as the director on the scene for this project in the development of agricultural higher education in the new nation of Indonesia. This sounded interesting. I hadn't been to the Southeast Asia except for a short visit. I had gone over and visited some of the project that had been going on over there in my role as vice president at Minnesota. But after a good deal of discussion, and then discussion with President Moose, I said that would be a good way to spend the sabbatical year, and also, since he wanted at least a 2-year commitment, it would require that I be placed on leave for mm-hmm. 2 years. President Moose agreed to that, and so I went to Jakarta And after I'd been there about 6 months, I suddenly got a call from John Weaver. John Weaver had been brought as the new president of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and then with the formation of the merged system, he had agreed in the series of compromises that were made about how they were going to set up the merged system to become president of the University of Wisconsin system. He probably has left his recollections of this.
Mm-hmm.
He was searching for what he called a senior academic vice president of the newly merged system. It was a job that had not been precisely filled, and he was proposing a more permanent organization after he got into the system, in which Mr. Percy, who was on the scene, would become a senior vice president for administration, and I would become a senior vice president for academic affairs. And he asked me if I had any interest, and I thought, well, this is interesting. Madison had been my old alma mater, and I had a lot of friends left in the communication arts department, so I said I would at least look at the job. I talked to Mr. Clodius, and he thought this was significant enough to the future of Western civilization so that if necessary, I could limit my stay in Indonesia to 1 year. And my wife and I flew back to Madison. We had to go through a search and screen operation with simply enormous. The faculty committee was quite mind-boggling.
Uh-huh.
The impromptu faculty administrative committee they'd set up for the system had about 30 people on it, and I think it was chaired by Robert Bach, the dean of the graduate school at Madison. So I spent a full afternoon being interrogated by this very large committee as to my views on academic affairs and higher education, and my views about what a system should or should not be. Well, they apparently were not totally disheartened with the answer. They'd already been embraced, and then I met with the regents. There was a regents selection committee, and then I prepared to go back to Jakarta to find out what had happened. But the next day, as I was about to get my plane for Jakarta, John Weaver had gone on from Madison out to Denver, and he wanted me to interrupt my flight back to Indonesia, my wife and I, to stop in Denver and to talk with him about taking the position. Apparently all his clearances were made. So we went to Denver, and he succeeded in convincing me that if I could get a release from President Moose, that this would be an interesting new venture. There had never been a system like it in the Middle West.
Right.
It looked like a change of occupations. It was going back to a place I had for which I had more very warm memories. And I told him that I would take the job, and I would agree to stay on for a minimum of 4 years.
This was in March.
Yeah, this was in the fall of 72.
Okay.
I said I would have to finish out the year and go through the annual review in Jakarta,
yeah,
and then I could come back in March and take up my work then, and take up my active work with the opening of the new year in the fall. So this all got settled very, very quickly, and I talked to President Moose on the telephone. He was very gracious about it, as he was always about things.
Mm-hmm.
And we went back to Jakarta and made our peace with the local authorities and went through the so-called big interagency review and so on, and then embarked back for Madison, where I got arrived right in the middle of about the culminating period of the budget process for the first budget of the merged system. I had read the budget, but I was very naive about what was actually going to take place. It looked to me like an interesting budget, and it turned out to be a lot more interesting than I had expected. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. you took the job, and the exactly what you were going to be doing was not clear to you at that point?
Oh, reasonably clear. I'd read the interim act, mm-hmm. and not the final chapter 36, which was passed. But I had read the draft copies, which were then in existence, of the what was to be the committee recommendation on Chapter 36. Some parts of it troubled me, but I was informed by John and by Frank Pelisek, who was to be president of the merged Board of Regents, that the matters had gone too far, and that it, they were really past the process point where they needed advice as to how to amend it. The mm-hmm. compromises had been difficult enough, so it had a lot of very interesting features, and it was very clear that the role that was expected of the system, among other things, was the so-called planning and coordination of higher education, public higher education, on a statewide basis in Wisconsin. Short-term and long-term planning, academic planning, were topics that interested me. The question of program review, that is the structure of the academic programs, mm-hmm. interested me, and the theory of doing that was very, very much underdeveloped in the entire nation. I thought it would be fun to see what we could do. I was interested in the opportunity that was presented for work on integrating budget policy and academic policy, bringing together the notion that the system budget and the system proposals for the budget would reflect and incorporate perspectives on academic development mm-hmm. for the institutions. And I thought my own notion was that under the terms of reference of Chapter 36, it was quite possible to maintain considerable autonomy for the chancellors and the institutions in the conduct of their own affairs, and perhaps to make the system an organization which, through effective planning and coordination, could be of some service to the universities of the system. That turned out to be a more complicated question than I had anticipated. Mm-hmm. What I had not really anticipated is that having committed himself politically with enormous investment of time, political energy, and political skills to bringing the merged system into being, that Governor Lucey would immediately set out to devastate it by a series of retrenchment budgets. I still am a little baffled by that. I've talked to mm-hmm. Governor Lucey a few times, even after I left system administration. I don't get very far with him because...
Communicating with him then?
Oh yes, I sat in on the first budget hearings, mm-hmm. and what was happening became clear almost immediately. He had encouraged the system to prepare a budget based on a productivity investment. Now theoretically, what that amounted to is we quickly relabeled it was a so-called productivity cut. Mm-hmm. In other words, our budget over the biennium, base budget for all of the institutions of the system, was to be cut by a flat 7%. But in theory, then, we were supposed to be able to bring forward to state government reinvestments of this amount of money in program developments, which would sort of contribute to more effective academic planning and development of the system. I thought the cuts would be very difficult to manage, but that the cuts joined a new investment might lead to some rather interesting opportunities. Well, of course, the 7% reinvestment proposals disappeared without a bubble, and the 7% cuts remained. So we were faced with a flat retrenchment budget for 2 years.
73 to 75.
Yeah. Yeah. And joined to that was the fact that a number of the institutions were having very serious enrollment declines at that in that biennium. And the state was not only taking the cuts in the base budget, but they were cutting sharply the enrollment funding money, so-called, that increment of our budget.
Mm-hmm.
And when I arrived, one of the jobs of the academic office under and the regents under Chapter 36 was to set up faculty, academic staff, personnel policies on a statewide basis. And here we were with a number of our universities already committed to the tenure layoff of tenured faculty members to balance our budgets in the fall of 1973-74. And there wasn't one stitch of personnel policy protocol standards for managing this in a legal way. So I had thought to get off to a rather leisurely start in the system, but the very first thing I had to try to do was set up interim policies and procedures to guide the conduct of a layoff of people for fiscal emergency, which was not an unheard of concept, but was dubiously legal unless there was some kind of due process being exercised. But that was the kind of scene that I mm-hmm. came into. And I say it startled me because I had thought for at least the first biennium, Governor Lucy would want to give us a chance to get started in a reasonably credible way. And instead, he presented us with an enormous crisis, and indeed, throughout the decade of the 70s, we were never engaged in very much more than crisis management. The, mm-hmm. the effort to get ahead with forward-looking planning was always being overtaken by the next budget crisis and the so on.
Well, Lucy's idea, one of his ideas about merger was that it would increase productivity in and of itself, and the creation of merger would lead to a more productive system. Was there any evidence of that occurring at all in the years that you were?
No, Lucy was an interesting political figure, I believe, and mm-hmm. Someday I think we'll receive a good deal of attention as a sort of a characteristic second generation Democratic liberal in the 1970s. In the 1970s, a lot of the Democratic governors, not just Lucy, but a lot of the others, were faced with the problem that the costs of liberal policies in state government had become so high that the popularity of their party with the taxpayers of the states had begun to be seriously jeopardized. They also faced the fact in states such as Wisconsin and Minnesota as well, that states of relatively modest means were supporting rather expensive per capita, in per capita terms, rather expensive higher educational systems, mm-hmm. that there had been a great emphasis on educational opportunity, that taxes on business were relatively high, that the welfare systems were well developed, that property taxes were rather high because the school systems were being well supported. And the theory developed out of a certain amount of naivete, I think, in latter day, in hindsight, that by better management, one could get more higher education at lower cost, could, in the repetitious phrase, squeeze duplication and waste out of higher education, cut out the fat, that the quality of education would be undiminished, but its unit costs would go down.
Mm-hmm.
And this would free up money for purposes of local assistance to keep the heat off the property taxes and make the mayors happy and the county boards happy, and politically had a great deal of clout in it. And it could also be used to lower certain kinds of business taxes, which were very, very unpopular with the business community, and perhaps prevent the erosion of the state's economy. So it was kind of a combination. And then there would be a great deal of emphasis on liberal policies in terms of legislation, as long as they didn't cost any money. As long as the costs, if any, were passed along mm-hmm. to either local or county government or to the other agencies and institutions of society. There's a great deal of story at both the state level and the national level about the amount of reform legislation that was passed, which had cost consequences, which were never confronted or borne by state government, but which became costly to the institutions who were caught up in the new legislation. And but management efficiency is a clue. You may remember that when Jimmy Carter got elected president, he talked about good management, save costs in the federal government. Mm-hmm. And there were Democrats all over the country talking about becoming good managers, and they had the notion that universities were badly managed, that those of us in academic administration and business administration in the universities were sort of amiable old fuddy-duddies who had never thought about the great insights of good management. It was a lot of nonsense, of course, but it what it added up to was that the Lucy, and he, in the sense what he was doing, what was also occurring in a lot of other states in the country, brought in a sort of brain trust a la John F. Kennedy of bright, ambitious, energetic graduates of many of them graduates of the Eastern Ivy League schools mm-hmm. who had very, very little experience, if any, with university administration, but a great deal of inoculation in the notion.
Do you remember who any of those people were?
Oh, yes. Bob Dunn, who was initially his his director of communication or press mm-hmm. secretary, later became a director of administration for a while, and I should make it clear that I have a good deal of respect for Bob Dunn, who was a very bright young man. On the other hand, it was almost impossible to convince him that he literally was quite ignorant about the management of large universities, and that the fact that he had a PhD and had taught at Brown University in public policy and so on, really didn't qualify him
mm-hmm.
and for that kind of expertise. Hal Wilde, who's now down at Beloit College as a vice president there, who actually worked for me over in the system after he left state government, was a member of this inner circle. Hal had a great deal more feeling for Wisconsin tradition, and I think was a much more, probably helped us more than most, although this is based on a lot of conversations I had with him about the dynamics of it. Jim Wood was very much in it, and of course it's still very much a part of the local political scene. There were other people who came in and out who served as sort of central figures. Lucy tended to bring in these aggressive, very bright, very well educated young people around him, and then systematically get them moved out into agencies of state government when the opportunity arose.
So it was their attitude towards the education system resulted in a real austerity, can we say, in terms of the budgets that they
allowed? Yes, they believed that the system was too expensive, and that by good management it could be made cheaper without reducing its quality. They were quite uninformed, and remained uninformed for the most part, about the fact that actually the University of Wisconsin-Madison was, if anything, as I used to say, excessively productive.
Mm-hmm.
That it was a very, very low cost university, which ranked as...
Even before the merger.
Yes. Ranked as still one of the three great, great public universities of the entire nation, and consistently in the big top 10 of the great research universities, public and private, of the nation, and that it was much the most inexpensive of any of those institutions.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go into the details of how it has managed to do all this. It's a fascinating...
Another time for that.
Yeah, case, I think, in point of a greatly productive university, which suddenly is faced with a state government that believes that by good management it can maintain its quality and not and cost less. They were fascinated with the fact that Wisconsin at the time seemed to have the second best supported higher education system of the nation. This had been a matter of pride in earlier generations, but they thought it was something the state couldn't afford.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that figure thrown at me over and over again. And I'd overlook such details as the fact that it was a bigger proportion of our young people went on to the university, that it was a great opportunity, that we were teaching more people. And but they had this dream that there were ways of doing it, that there was a technology for doing it. It was very much in the air in the 70s. And I used to comment in some of the national meetings that I thought there probably was less fat in the higher education system of Wisconsin than in almost any in the country.
Okay.
But we were almost the first public higher education system of the country to cut to face systematic programs of budget cutting.
So that happened as a result of the first budget, 73 to 75, and again in 75, another cut.
Yes, another big cut. And in 75, we were faced with a whole series of so-called analysis papers from the Department of Administration showing how we could take $40 million out of the budget. Most of those proposals, and I won't go into them, were ridiculous. But when we confronted the DOA analysts and even Governor Lucey with the statement that all of these cuts they're proposing in the budget we're proposing won't sustain any kind of analysis, they'd be absolutely untenable, mm-hmm. and they will not accomplish, and all they'll do is throw the entire, all of the universities into a crisis. Why, the answer was, well, the $40 million are still going to come out. You, if you don't like how we're going to do it, why, you do it. Well, it, I won't go into the, we didn't do it all. And we did, in that biennium, managed to break slightly the governor's executive budget with the legislature, which was almost unprecedented. And it was a very marginal break, but we did at least begin to get some belief that we were just not being given the opportunity to carry out the work of great universities and to protect the quality of the universities. That was a year also when the governor wrote the regents and told them that he wanted a study made within the next 3 months before the end of the budget cycle, showing how we were going to reduce the scope of the public institutions in Wisconsin. The theory that had developed down in DOA was that some of the four-year institutions and a lot of the two-year campuses should be closed. And he was in effect saying to the regents that he wanted the regents and the system administration to study which should be closed so that the quality and budgets of the others could be protected. And we produced in 3 months, I chaired the statewide planning committee, so-called, that wrote in 3 months an enormous report. It's about a 5-foot shelf of books, and then it had about a 60-page summary, which we delivered only about 3 days late to the governor and all the members of the legislature. And that's where we advanced the a series of premises, in effect saying to state government, you can reduce the scope of the University of Wisconsin system and close colleges and institutions, and you can save money, but the only way you can do it is to deny access to a lot of people who've gone to college in the past. We set up what I call the Iron Triangle of costs, quality, and access. And we said, if you want to protect quality and reduce costs, you're going to have to give up access. If you want to protect quality and access, you've got to quit chiseling on costs. You've got to pay it. And that in a short form was the argument.
Which side of that triangle do you think was cut the most here on in the Madison campus in those years?
Oh, Madison, to a remarkable extent, I think, assimilated cost reductions and maintained the strength and quality of its research enterprise, and I think its graduate enterprise, and I think maintained a very strong undergraduate program. I did argue that in reality, although I think the undergraduate program is still a remarkably high quality program, I think teaching loads grew excessive, teaching supplies deteriorated, the support services for classroom instruction deteriorated. Not disastrously, it still may be one of the best undergraduate public mm-hmm. university programs in the country, but it's not, I believe, what it could have been had the budgets not sustained those blows. And the recovery of all the investment that needs to be made really to achieve at the undergraduate level the it seems to me the level of distinction that has been maintained at the graduate level and in the research program is going to call for renewed investments.
Mm-hmm.
I'm confident of that. I could tell that story in my own department where we could do a better job if we had more faculty and the same number of students. We know exactly what we would do, and it would be a better curriculum and would be better taught.
But the campus has held its own, you think?
Yeah, it's held its own.
Do you think that's come at the expense of the other campuses that it has been merged with?
No. To some extent, I think the system was able to shield the quality of Madison, although not wholly. You can't shield when the totality of the budget is constantly down, down, mm-hmm. down. But we did our best to reallocate funding among and within the other institutions to protect, insofar as we could, the quality of those institutions. They've been up against some very serious problems, some of them, and others have had, because of their enrollment situations, have had difficulty getting their unit costs back under control. The quality of instruction hasn't really suffered at those institutions, however.
Let's talk then. We've been talking mostly about some of these detrimental effects of merger along mm-hmm. with the budget cuts. Can you speak to some of the achievements of the merge system? And I know in the first year or two that you were working, you had worked with auditing programs and rewriting the missions.
I think the new mission statements may have made a contribution through time to better planning in the state of Wisconsin, and may also have been somewhat protective of Madison. Those mission statements are a good deal more specific than the earlier ones. One thing they did do, and this was by design, very carefully, was to say that we are not further going to encourage the development of any PhD level public higher education institutions in this state. That we have a comprehensive program at Madison, we have a more narrow and more specialized program at Milwaukee, and that's all the state can afford and all it needs. I'm going to have to take a pause here.
Okay.
Continue that with the question of some of the things that I think a merger at least facilitated. One, I said, was the development of more specific missions, and in effect, missions that controlled the aspirations of the non-doctoral institutions. There had been a kind of monotonous history in public higher education in America, whereby teachers' colleges had become state colleges had become state universities had immediately set about becoming doctoral universities, and then usually tried to develop research competence after they mm-hmm. started offering some doctorates, and everyone who had been in academic affairs in big research universities knew that this had to stop sometime. There were very serious, I think, problems with the quality of doctoral education in many, many of the institutions that had come into it through ambition rather than through genuine readiness. And I think there was a great deal of impetus right down that path in the state of Wisconsin. These are the universities of the old state university system are many of them very estimable and very high quality teaching institutions, but there was really no limit to the way in which they envisioned their own future. And I thought we were extremely fortunate to be able to preempt further expansion of institutions offering the doctorate, public institutions offering the doctorate, mm-hmm. at a time when Madison offered about 135 doctoral programs, of which almost 100 are unique to the state. That's the only program in the state. A few of them are found in similar form at Milwaukee, not identical form, and at Marquette. But at the very most, in a few fields, we have three doctoral programs instead of 14. And we were not faced with a nasty problem of trying to put a lot of PhD programs out of business that should never have been in business. And we did have the opportunity, I think, to curb aspirations in terms of realism before the barn door got open further. And I think the statewide personnel policies were useful. Actually, I think while they were modeled after Madison's faculty code extensively, which wasn't accidental, I worked very closely with Madison, the university committee people, as well as with a statewide committee of faculty on the development of those. I suspect system faculty personnel policies resulted in improvements and strengthening of the Madison faculty personnel policies, even though they were very, very well developed. I know they gave to the rest of the universities of the state, with a couple of exceptions, or two or three exceptions, a concept of faculty participation in personnel work, which they had never internalized and had great difficulty actually assimilating and bringing into their customs.
You also, there was also some scaling down across the state, not only of graduate programs, but of undergraduate curriculums as well?
We did an enterprise of audit and review of master's level programs across the state. And we were able, with the agreement of the institutions, to close about 100 or 130 of them. The truth was that it, as I've said, it was primarily a matter of purging the catalog. Mm-hmm. The programs that were put out of business were almost without exception programs with very few students, and had been in that condition for at least 3 or 4 years. In other words, they were underutilized to the point where it was ridiculous to try to maintain the notion that you had a program running. When people said, "How much money did you save?" Well, we didn't save money. What I used to talk about then was we had at least foregone some pressures on costs. is if you close a program that's been unproductive for a long time, you dampen the enthusiasm of the people who are associated with it for trying to figure out a way of getting it revitalized and getting more students and generally getting back into business. Mm-hmm. And we didn't put anything out of business that, in the judgment of both the institution and the majority of the institution, not all of the faculty, but and of our system people, was not a critical higher educational need of anybody.
So these weren't cuts that came as a result forced upon you by austere budgets. They were rather looking at the programs in the state on their own merit.
The speed with which that first search and destroy enterprise mm-hmm. was undertaken was forced on us by budget realities. We were in effect told that unless we convinced the legislature we were serious about examining duplication and waste, that it would go even harder with us in the next budget. Mm-hmm. That was a very clear message we were getting, and a very, in my judgment, a very obnoxious message.
Mm-hmm.
But the enterprise was not conducted so poorly, and actually the legislature was quite impressed with what we did accomplish. We very quickly moved to change it from a system called audit and review, that's where it had started, to a system called the review of academic programs. And the purpose of the system was decentralized to the institutions, and the central purpose was to permit the faculties of the institutions to assume fully their responsibility for the quality of their academic programs. In that sense, a program would be put out of business only if, in the judgment of the faculty and the administration or whatever mechanism it set up, it was of dubious quality because of resource situations and the question of its future, the ability of the institution to turn it into a mm-hmm. productive and high-quality program, was suspect.
Okay.
Now, some institutions have closed programs with the systems they've set up. So the system works pretty well if you say the purpose of it is quality and not to save money.
Well then, can we talk about maybe another effect or two or change? For example, has there been a difference when you have a centralized system in dealing with the Capitol and the legislature rather than the numerous different unmerged campuses bargaining?
I think my greatest worry about the whole idea of the system, and it's a very serious worry, is the extent to which its existence invites political pressure upon all of the universities.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the great, at least one of the great traditional qualities that a university ought to possess is what I refer to as a decent distance from political processes and political pressures and decisions. I could go on at length historically why universities should not be should not be thought of as state agencies serving the purposes of state government or of government. They are, I used to try to say, better thought of as agencies of the state. They're funded by, chartered by, and created by government. But wise governments set them up with a board of regents and with independence in terms of faculty governance to keep this distance and don't try to get into the clockwork of management. It's easier for that to take place when you have a lot of universities, each with its own separate governing board. It becomes too complicated for political power to get at it.
Right.
Effectively, it can fuss and fume and raise all sorts of good crises from time to time, but it's a very hard thing to deal with. In the creation of a single system, it means that people who exercise political power now believe that they have available to them an administration and a single board of regents which can exercise power over the several universities, and because they're dependent upon the government then for their money, will pay very close attention to what it is the governor wants or what it is the legislative leaders want.
Mm-hmm.
And that therefore both the temptation to use to politicize the university and the opportunity to politicize it tend to be greatly increased.
Do you see any evidence of that in
yes.
the last few years?
Mm-hmm. But I don't want to say it's simply the function of Wisconsin politics or the Wisconsin merged system. In some ways, the merger is a symptom of it, of political ambition mm-hmm. rather than a consequence or a cause.
Right.
It, I think we have lived, and we probably still are living, in a period when governments have become increasingly aggressive, and government agencies and government officials have become increasingly proud of their own importance and prestige and significance to the future of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
So that government itself has become something of a threat to the institutions of society, at least as I view it in a rather morbid way. And I say that as an old Franklin Delano Roosevelt liberal and a person who believes that government has a creative and constructive role to play, but I think has lost in many ways the sense of restraint that it should bring to bear in its relationships with the universities. I give innumerable examples of what I regard to be egregious intrusion, very, very difficult kinds of intrusion.
Mm-hmm.
They're not unique to Wisconsin, but some of them are more highly polished here than any place in the country as far as I can find out. Position control. Telling the university's not that here is your budget and use it wisely, and then you have the obligation to explain to us how you've used it, but telling us that you can only appoint so many people, here's your budget, but if you want to appoint more than X number of faculty members, you can't do it because you've exceeded the controls, and the control number is voted by us.
Mm-hmm.
And is therefore a sacred number which you can't violate without violating the law. Position control system started out very innocuously and very amiably. And as by the end of the decade, there were many, many political leaders who were perceiving it as a major instrument of power over the university, which it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's devastating. It's extraordinarily stupid from a management point of view. It's wasteful, even though it pretends to be undertaken for purposes of saving money.
How in that sense is it wasteful?
Well, it's wasteful because it says if you can could spend money more wisely by taking some money this year from a capital and putting it into the salary of a faculty member, getting an additional faculty member, or converting some of your civil service system positions into faculty positions, or even vice versa. Certain circumstances, you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because our numbers tell you how many you can have. It has potentially, ultimately, at the end of the rainbow, as we fought over in the 70s, the kind of awful dream of a state government telling you, you've only got so many full professors. The fact that you've got associate professors who ought to be promoted now is too bad. They'll have to wait their turn because we not only tell you how many faculty you can have, now we're going to tell you how many of each type.
This is something that you see coming, or that's not?
Well, no, it didn't come.
Yeah.
But it was very clearly in the back of the mind of some of the people who were developing the technology of position control.
Mm-hmm.
It still is there. It's still a threat and hangs around like a bad penny. We couldn't put it out of business, although we did control it to some extent with the help of a great many legislators who did understand the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The budget system is more rigid in Wisconsin than almost any state higher educational system in the country, or any major university in the country, in the sense of the constraints it puts on the ability of the regions to move money from one budget category to another without prior approval from government. The legislature gave us
This is still September 17th. We're still talking with Professor Donald Smith, and we were just talking about the budget system here in the state and its mm-hmm. effect on the university.
We were giving some examples of political intrusion.
Right.
We had tried to get the legislature, because it was underfunding us, to help us by giving opportunities for faculty to take sabbatical leaves and educational development leaves so that they could at least renew themselves occasionally, given the weight of the teaching loads and the increased teaching loads. Wisconsin was about the only public university, in fact it was the only. Madison would have been the only big research university in the Big Ten without a sabbatical system, and maybe nationally. I won't go into the history of how this came to be,
mm-hmm.
but the legislature then agreed that they'd authorize a sabbatical system with a very sharp limit on the number of people who could go on sabbatical leave. I think it was 0.5%. As one could point out cynically, generations of faculty would die before all of them could could have a leave. Even on most universities, it's a kind of regular 7-year mm-hmm. reprieve for renewal and recharging and academic or scholarly development. Then, to make matters worse, they didn't put any funding in it, but they had this limit on the number. Then they set up a reporting system. My own cynical estimate, which I shared with a good many of the legislators, was that you've given us the opportunity to spend a maximum of about $175,000 of our own money, which isn't very much in a $150 million budget. But then you put in reporting requirements in which we have to report back to state government how we've used each of these unfunded leaves and what the productivity of it has been. And I said, I calculate it's going to cost us about $150,000 in faculty time, administrative time, to put together this report. So I said, it isn't much of a bargain, really. I've often wondered whether we shouldn't have said, no, we don't want it. I think in retrospect, if I were reliving it, I would have said that at the time. Most of us agreed, including most of the chancellors, that it was best to get the name and the principle established and then see what we could begin to do with it. And maybe in time, we would have a genuine sabbatical system established. But that's what I mean by an inability to do anything, even presumably friendly things, without such scrutiny and such specification of how we can use the money, that in effect the government is trying to manage the academic decisions.
Yeah. Well, do you see then that in the future, let us look forward maybe a little, that a disaggregation or a tendency for the system to disaggregate and be able to deal with the legislator separately would be favorable or would have a favorable effect?
I think if the state government is genuinely concerned, and I think a lot of them are, about preserving the national stature of UW-Madison and the unique contribution this university makes to the economy of the state, the quality of life in the state, and in general to the whole prestige and reputation of the state. Mm-hmm. If they really mean to do that, some disaggregation better take place. They've got to stop the business of aggregating salary policy and personnel policy toward Madison with policy for all universities in the state. And even more, they've got to stop aggregating those with policy toward all state employees. Separate budget treatment for Madison and Milwaukee and other universities would be a first step.
Mm-hmm.
And could be accomplished short of merger. I have other ideas of ways that disaggregation could take place. I think it's going to be very painful and very difficult. It's, as we say, a little bit like getting the toothpaste back in the tube.
Right.
Once you've created a new mechanism, unwinding it is much more complicated than not having wound it up in the first place. In a curious way, it may be that sometime collective bargaining will force the disaggregation, because if a substantial number of the universities were to choose to go into collective bargaining on the part of the faculties, and faculty governance was to become a dead letter, then I think the notion of a unified personnel administration through a single board of regents and a single set of system officers would become just confusing beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. We've entered a period when the political impulse now is running quite heavily in favor of stopping increasing punitive action toward the university, a kind of recognition that things went too far. And quite a few political leaders now speak favorably out of decentralizing,
mm-hmm.
things now controlled by state government to the regions. quite a few of them speak about trying to undo the damage they've done in terms of the budget. And quite a few of them seem to recognize the punitive efforts to run the university out of the state capital aren't really very efficient, very effective. They don't save money. They just create trouble. So it's a period of potential goodwill based, oddly enough, on the economic distress of the state. The fact is that you've suddenly become aware of the fact that a very strong research university and very strong higher education facilities are an invaluable asset to the economic future of the state. So the university's become important in a way that it perhaps it was in 1973, but didn't seem to be. So disaggregation, there may be a period of goodwill if there is a period free from serious political crises and economic crises in the state. Perhaps some levels of disaggregation could be addressed usefully.
Okay.
Yay?
Yeah. Well, that'll do it then?
I think so. I guess I want to say that I may sound a little dour about the system. As a person who was materially and centrally involved in its development over a period of about 8 or 9 years, but I do think those were very, very troubled years, and particularly we have to, the state of Wisconsin and its political leadership as well as its educational leadership have to ask how we can prevent the leveling effect, which is almost potential in the idea of a system, from at some time seriously and permanently damaging the quality of UW-Madison.
Right.
Which I think would be a great loss to the state. I once said, totally without effect, to Governor Lucy in private conversation, I was somewhat angry. I said, you know, in lots of ways, Wisconsin is a state with a great reputation nationally and internationally. It's a lovely state. But I said, in other ways, if you look at it to the cold eye, it's a sort of bucolic way station between Chicago and Minneapolis. I was serious about it. I said, we don't have any international airport. We don't have a Federal Reserve Bank. Our greatest city, Milwaukee, is in many ways a sort of a very large bubble on the edge of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that western third of the state looks to Minneapolis as its cultural and shopping and economic center, and that's where the action is. And I said it's got a lot of cows, a lot of water, and a lot of green fields and some hardworking people. But I said it has one luminous asset, and that's UW-Madison. I said, why in the world would you want to sit down here damaging the one thing that has made this state distinctive? And he smiled peacefully, of course denied that that was his intention.
Yeah, what was his, he was always quick to respond that merger was going to be favorable to Madison. What's your impression of his idea there?
I think in part he was caught up in that kind of neoliberal management notion of the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
That liberals now, by being great managers, can force tired old fat institutions to shape up. I think in part he may have started with the assumption that the merged system would reduce the scope of the system, would protect Madison's budget, cut costs by closing institutions out over the state. If you look at the demography of Wisconsin, that was a political pipe dream from the first.
Mm-hmm.
And we were faced with ironic situations. One that I recall so well in 75, the analysts in the Department of Administration were busy writing a secret paper on which institutions, four-year institutions, ought to close. And they decided, well, at least one and maybe two on the western border of Platteville across River Falls, Superior. Too many, right up against the border of Minnesota and or Iowa and Minnesota and Iowa, and then just a little ways off is Stout, and a little ways further on is Eau Claire. So they thought one of the best ones, probably one of the optimal ones to go, because so many of its students came from Minnesota, would be River Falls. Well, about the time they were circulating this draft report, which of course had been put together at Lucy's behest, he's out speaking at the 75th anniversary of the University of Wisconsin River Falls, and assuring the assembled multitudes that the next 100 years are going to be even more glorious than the last. And I used to say, oh.
Of course, that report never...
It never surfaced. It was leaked to us, and it was circulated, and it died it was never brought to culmination or referred to again. But it was in the very fact of that abortive outrage, that the very notion that such a report was being prepared without consultation,
mm-hmm.
that he issued his famous letter to the regents in the system, directing that we set about telling how to reduce the scope of the system.
Right. This is 75 for the
second. Yeah, 75. Okay. And so that, I think there were lurking in his minds ways that he could dream of it protecting rather than eroding Madison.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not really a very, very good analysis of either higher education, a very good understanding of either higher education, or I think the history and demography of the state of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.